All right, we are good to go. I'm Ethan Sharp. It's November 16th, 2020. I'm here in Lexington, Kentucky. And Ruben, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, well, my name is Ruben Perez, and I am originally from the island of Puerto Rico. And many people, when they meet me, they say, "So, how you ended up in Kentucky?" So, I have lived in Lexington now for it's going to be 19 years in January of 2021. The reason why I came to Kentucky was because I came to do my master's at UK in health promotion, which I graduated from in 2005, with also with a specialization in gerontology. My plans were I'm going to go to Kentucky, do my degree, and I'm going to go back to Puerto Rico. But like I've always told everybody, this city grows on you. It's charming. It's not too big. It's not too small. There's a lot of things to do. It's peaceful. And I decided to, in the meantime, while I was in my last semester, I got a part-time at the health department, translating for a program called HANDS, which is for first-time moms. And once I graduated, they offered me a full-time job in the community education department, or it was health promotion at the time, where I've been ever since. And I decided to take it as a health educator. And I've been there now for 15 years. Now, my roles have changed, because I started as a tobacco educator. And then I took over, I was in charge of all the arthritis programs for the city, since I have also a bachelor's in exercise science. So I did that for a few years, and then I became what I'm currently today. I'm the worksite wellness coordinator for the agency. Pretty much my job is to keep our employees healthy, or help them to stay healthy.
All city employees. Is that correct?
Oh, health department employees.
Oh, health
All
department
health.
employees. And so you didn't you so when you first started there at the health department, you were working some with the Latino community, with the Spanish speaking community, but that hasn't been your focus at the health department.
In my first, I will say my first 5 years, I was pretty hands-on with them because we were trying always to do the tobacco prevention and the arthritis programs also in Spanish. I was part of some groups, some boards that met, trying to have all that information given in Spanish. But once I went into my current job, then I was more an in-house person with our own employees. And we used to be a very big agency because when I started, we used to be about 450 employees. But then the crisis of 2008 happened with the economy, and then we were forced to shut down many of our programs, where now we are about 130 employees.
That's a big drop. That's a big
That's a,
drop.
yeah, that's a big drop.
And so have you, before we start talking about 2020, did you really see the Latino community grow during that time, since you started until now?
Oh yes, because our department also, we are the ones who do a lot of health fairs in the community, and we attend other health fairs, providing our information about our programs, and that's how you could get a feeling how the community was doing, how it was growing, and I remember because of the scale of the health fairs, you know. So for a while, you could see, I would say from 2005 to 2008 or 9, you could see how the growth of the community was growing. I think it took a hit about 2008 when the economy got bad. A lot of people then stopped when started going back to their countries. And but then after around 2010, 2011, you have seen that it has grown again.
And would you many of the folks who are, who make up the Latino community Are they of Mexican descent or Central American descent? Or is there a Puerto Rican population too there?
So, you know, we are 19 countries that speak Spanish.
Right.
So that's one thing that I would tell people to understand. There are 19 countries, which the only similarity that we have is that we speak Spanish in some words, because when we start comparing how we pronounce certain, especially food items or certain other stuff, it's totally different. So it's 19 different cultures that we're united by the same language somewhat. Right. And yes, the majority in Lexington, I would say, are from Mexican descent. Mm-hmm. But then you have Cubans, Puerto Ricans, you have Dominicans, El Salvador, you know, all. I would say you have a representation of all the countries in Lexington, but with a big majority being from Mexican descent.
Right. So let's move into 2020 now, and maybe you could start us off with talking about how the health department was, you know, how was it involved in responding to the pandemic? Because that's something that I don't think everyone understands. So what was the health department's role in, you know, helping prepare the city for the pandemic?
Well, before we talk about that, I want to take you back when we had the H1N1 pandemic.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm.
The health department has always told their employees that part of your job is, if there's ever any type of emergency citywide, you will be called to help. Mm-hmm. So everybody has a clear understanding that when, for example, H1N1 happened, ice storms could happen, or things that affect a large scale of the community, you might be called to help. When H1N1 happened, I also help a lot with the Hispanic community, because it was all about the dissemination of information.
Right.
And at that time, we didn't have the social media components that we have right now. Everybody was not involved. So it was more of a hands-on, going to the places, flyers, going door by door, going to the radio. But that helped us prepare. So many of the officers that were dealing with this pandemic this time, many of them were part of the H1N1 pandemic. We already had that knowledge. So it was a lot easier this time to when COVID happened, although COVID is a bigger scale, something we didn't know in terms of like what we were going to do. So in terms of the Hispanic community, the first thing we did was that we identified employees that were bilingual that could help in the dissemination of information, because that was our number one goal, right? We needed to create awareness and pass along, you know, what the governor was mandating and things like that.
Right.
So they identified those employees. I was one of them. Mm-hmm. And since I've been there the longest of the ones that they identified, I was given the title, like the, let's say, the communications officer for the Spanish speaking community for the response, COVID-19, just for the COVID-19 response. That's why you've seen me. I've been doing Facebook Lives. I've been doing interviews, radio interviews. I've been on the media. So in terms of the response in general, so we had two components. I guess the first role of the agency was to first create awareness and create all this media awareness, whether it was English or Spanish. Right. But we also had the understanding with our epi department, epidemiology, that we were going to start having cases sooner or later. We were going to have cases. So they started training everybody or they chose also individuals who were going to work in their contact tracing or case investigation part. That's where our biggest part of the response has been. So we also developed a call center which we had other set of employees that were all just going to be working our call center, which runs 7 days a week, 8:30 to 4:30, to answer questions about COVID or let people know where they need to go to get tested. And so we even developed a reporting system before the state even did. So I would say COVID started on March, and I would say by the end of April, we were already running with our, you know, we were already doing case investigation, contact tracing, doing our own stats of reporting, and we had the call center running, and then we were doing all these things on the side, translating everything into Spanish, doing radio interviews, Facebook Live, which I do every Thursday.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Every Thursday, I've been doing a Facebook Live since April.
Okay.
We partnered with the Radio Lex.
Yes.
And they have been very instrumental in our dissemination of information. Mm-hmm. Of course, we put stuff through our Facebook page and our Twitter page. But one of the barriers with the Hispanic community is that after, let's say, people older than 45, they don't have social media. So that's where we start. We have the challenges.
Yeah. When did you all start preparing? Did it start in January or did it start in, at what time during this year did you start getting?
I know that we had a communication go out to the media saying that we had opened our dock, which is because we were treating this like an emergency response. So the dock is where it's our center where the people leading the response, that's where you have the commissioners and the officers, they start meeting and they start preparing, you know.
Okay.
So I would say it was maybe it could have been as early as February where they started already planning the planning process. But we also have a position at the health department, which is an emergency management response coordinator, that's their job. So year round, they're making plans about emergencies that could happen.
That right. What two quick questions just to clarify. So do you remember when H1N1 was, what year that was?
I know it was under the Obama administration, but maybe close to 2000. It had to be somewhat close to between 2008 to 2010.
Okay.
Along those lines.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that would be something easy to look up.
Yeah. I just want to check. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was saying that when that came out, it was really scary because if you remember, it was killing. It started heavily in Mexico. It was killing Hispanics. People that were getting it were actually dying fairly quick. So, you know, people were really freaking out, about H1N1. Yeah. But luckily for us, it ended up not being as bad as like COVID has been.
You know? Yeah, that's true. And then you said you had a team of folks in the department who were bilingual. I was just curious how many folks would that be that in your team?
Well, currently 20 plus.
Oh, okay.
Between all our, because, you know, most of our clerks at the clinic are bilingual. Most of the workers at Hands and WIC. And then in other departments, we also have people, you know, that are bilingual and in administration. Yeah. So, yes. So I would say close to 20.
Yeah. And then 15 years ago, there weren't that many, right?
No, 15 years ago, I remember we were at the point where we used to have, there were more, but remember, we were about 458.
Oh, that's true. You had a lot of employees.
So if you went by percentages, maybe it was kind of the same, but we used to have to hire interpreters for the clinic.
Okay. Well, let's talk then about, you know, sort of how things progressed with the Latino community with COVID-19. You know, I don't know if you can kind of tell us the story of how things, you know, went from no cases to, you know, cases going pretty rapidly up. I don't know when that happened. If you can kind of walk us through that a little bit.
Well, I remember that at the beginning we were getting, you know, small amount of cases of maybe 20 per week. Uh-huh. You know, when we first started, and there weren't that many Hispanic cases. Beginning, maybe once every 2 days, or you know, one per day. Initially, the first, I think when reports started coming out that how he was affecting the African American community.
Yeah.
And how it was like they were only 15% of the population, but their total amount of cases were about 30%. Mm-hmm. So it was double. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were very wary with the programs and Facebook's lives about it and how we could improve. And, you know, we were thinking that the Hispanic community at the time was doing a good job. We were already doing Facebook lives and promoting. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. then the virus came and touched the horse industry. Ah. That's the first mm-hmm. one that it touched. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one day, we get 17 cases at once coming from the horse industry.
Wow.
Okay, and then by the next 2 days, now we had about 35 cases from the horse mm-hmm. industry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where we, you know, we say, okay, this is going to start affecting, because usually if you understand that Hispanic households, they don't tend to be just a husband and wife, and that's it. They tend to be husband and wife. Usually they have, I would say, close to an average of 4 kids. Sometimes grandparents might be there or uncles might be there. So, but those first cases that we were getting in the horse industry, it happened to be from Hispanics that were not from Lexington.
Oh.
And I learned a lot about horses at that time doing case investigation. I guess there are groups of Hispanics that they travel year round with horse trainers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they go from racetrack to racetrack for, you know, they will come to Kingland, spend here about 2 months mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And training horses. Okay. And then they move along.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Initially it was believed that all that epidemic that happened in the area of Kingland and other farms was due to a group that I had come from Florida.
Oh.
And then it progressed because these were people that were living in close quarters, even though mm-hmm. everybody has their own rooms, they were close quarters. And once once one person got it, it started spreading like wildfire.
Yeah.
So one of the good things that Kingland did was that they were really aggressive with their protocols, how they were going to deal with it. And I remember they pretty much rented an entire hotel.
Oh.
And they were removing people from Kingland and sending them to the hotel where mm-hmm. people were having to stay there for their mm-hmm. for their isolation 10 to 14 days, and mm-hmm. they were providing them with food, and they wouldn't let them leave until they were cleared by the health department to be released. So that's where it started. But then from there, it started hitting the farms.
Yeah.
And at that time, that's when you start getting this big uproar of cases. Mm-hmm. Because then when you're hitting people that are from their farms, then those people have families here, and that starts spreading to the family.
Right.
And then it's when we start seeing that instead of getting maybe 5 Hispanic cases a week, now we were getting 20 cases a week, mm-hmm. and 30 mm-hmm. cases a week. And mm-hmm. it went to the point that at one moment in time, we became 28% of all the cases that we had at the time. Very discrepant, a big discrepancy, because we're only 6% of the community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From there, then it really started hitting the construction industry.
Yeah.
And that's when it really exploded, way more than the horse industry, because with the construction, there's some characteristics that are really hard to combat against. For example, they usually travel in groups. They have to work in the project together. It's really hard to tell people to be wearing a mask if it's 95 outside in the heat.
Right.
They tend to be really young and they don't get much symptoms.
Yeah.
And many people in that industry, for example, you could have one household that has five guys living in the household. None of them are related. So when it came time to do case investigation and contact tracing, those things became really challenging because sometimes they don't, even though they sleep in the same household, they don't know the other person's number so that became really challenging because all we were trying to do is stop the spread, right?
Right.
So that was one of the biggest challenges always to this day, is being like, when we get cases like that, is being able to contact everybody and making them understand of the importance of them staying home and not spreading. But you also have to understand, these are people that don't have benefits.
Right.
Just like the horse industry, landscaping, roofing, construction, is either you work or you don't get paid.
Right.
So when you put it like that, sometimes, across the board, many times they went to work. They're forced to go to work. And they cannot just do like we did, that when they told us, okay, we're going to stay home, you need to stay home for the next 2 weeks. Okay, well, if I needed to, I can take them from my vacation time.
Yeah, right. And when you would tell people to quarantine or stay home, would they sometimes tell you, I can't do that?
Immediately, the first thing we'll say, so who's going to pay my bills?
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that the health department did or does is that we will help you.
Okay.
If we quarantine you, we will help you with food. We'll bring you food. We'll help you with some of your prescriptions. We'll try to bring it to you. There are other agencies that are helping with rent and the utilities. It was a lot easier at the beginning because there were also mandates from the governor that no one could get evicted.
Right.
They could not cut your utility bills. So those things now, they have been taken out.
Right.
But we were trying to make it as easy as possible for the people that we were putting in isolation, because we were trying to have them understand, we're just trying to save lives. And it's interesting because if you see now that we are what we call the second wave, now is when things are really exploding at a certain level that I've never seen. We just had our biggest day ever with 265 cases in one day, right?
Let me just go back a minute. So you were talking about the case investigations. Is that basically contact tracing, or do you sometimes visit the sites and try to find, what's happening there? I'm just wondering how the case investigation works.
Yeah, so case investigation is the first step. Mm-hmm. And everything is going to be done over the phone to protect the employee.
Okay.
They're not going to send anybody to any site. So case investigation is the initial contact. So let me explain the process from beginning to end. A person is feeling symptoms. They decide to go get tested. They get tested, right? That provider, wherever they go, could be a hospital, could be an urgent care center, or it could be a free clinic. That provider, once they get the results, they're going to contact the individual, let them know the results. And then they're going to send us the results with the name and phone number for that person.
Okay.
Okay, that person gets put on a board, official case, and then it is given to an investigator. That's what I am. I was a case investigator. And then I do the initial contact with the person. And I do an interview that it can take up to an hour, where I'm going to get everything from where they live, where they work, what they do, their symptoms, what they have, and activity history, where they have been for the last, usually we ask them 2 days before they had any symptoms, what did they do? Where did they go? Mm-hmm. Then we ask them about all their household contacts, and then we ask them about all their contacts. Mm-hmm. A contact is defined any person who was less than 6 feet for more than 15 minutes with that person that became an active case. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's a contact.
Yeah.
And then we get all that information. But like I said, sometimes we get people that in those 2 days before they got tested, they went everywhere. Yeah. I went to Walmart. I went to Kroger. I visited this person. So the history takes a long time. And then at the end of the interview, after we have gathered all that information, then we read them what they need to do, why they need to stay home, how is this mandated by the law, all this stuff. Okay, yeah. That's the case investigation. Right. From there, all the contacts that yeah. person provided that are not household contacts
mm-hmm.
Are given to a contact tracer.
Okay.
And then those people try to contact the right. So I was doing the initial part, which is gathering as much information so we can give it to our other contact tracers. Yeah. Then the last component, once those people are put in isolation, there's a monitoring department.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you either a daily call or they send you a daily email asking you about your symptoms.
Okay.
And according to those answers is how we determine when you are going to be released from isolation.
I see. Yeah.
And
when you contact someone, when you're doing the contact tracing, you ask them to go get tested. Usually, is that one of the things that?
Yes. If they were named and we determine that they have been in contact with that person, yes, we ask them. Go get tested, because the advantage of getting tested is that if you are given positive, your isolation clock starts counting immediately. If not, in the worst case of scenarios, then you could be what is considered the now I'm forgetting the incubation period.
And
the incubation period could take from 2 to 14 days. Mm-hmm. And then the active period could take another 10 to 14 days. Mm-hmm. So that's why we tell them, yes, you want to go get tested.
Okay.
As soon as possible.
It seems like, a lot of folks wouldn't take the time to get tested, for fear that they might test positive or something. And so do you find that to be a challenge?
Well, not once we have you. Once we have
once your data, you're not in touch with them, right?
now we have you. Go get tested, because if you want to go back to work as soon as possible, you want to go get tested. Right. And I've always felt that the worst case scenario actually is when someone, for example, we have household that the father is positive, but the mom keeps coming up negative. That is the worst case scenario. Why? Because the protocol is as follows. When the father is done with the isolation, then the mom is going to start her isolation.
Right.
But so his quarantine was 14 days. Her ended up being 28 days.
Mm.
That's the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I had a case like that with a lady that it was the grandmother and the grandson. The grandson was like 6 years old. He was the positive one. And she kept coming negative, and that was driving her crazy, because she needed to go back to work, but she mm-hmm. came up coming negative, so she was not going to get released until he would finish his isolation.
Yeah, that would be very difficult. Mm-hmm. So in terms of hospitalization rates and actual fatality rates, have those been higher with the Hispanic community, or have they been pretty much what we're seeing with the general population?
No, I think, I don't think they have been higher with the Hispanic community, because the Hispanic community has had a lot of cases that are under the age of 43.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cases. And I think, you know, if I can, I can look it up right now, right here, to see what are today. But I think with, if you think about it, I think that only under the age of 43 in the entire, among all communities, we may only have three deaths. So it's something that is not affecting.
Right. Right. Right.
I can see here right now. Yeah. Yes, we've only had three deaths in the entire city under the age of 44.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's coming out of like almost 7,000 to 8,000 cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we talk specifically about the Hispanic community, I remember that about 41% of all our cases are close to under age of 34. Yeah. So yeah, we barely have had any, you know, death, but we have some, about 7 or 8 out of the 104.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That's one thing that we used to have a lot of great data, but when we started transitioning to the state reporting system, then some of that data now is not available because we used to have it broken down by race.
Oh, okay.
I would have been able to tell you exactly how many deaths we have so far in the Hispanic community, what ages, but now I can't.
Yeah.
I only have overview.
Yeah. I see. So the state system doesn't break deaths down by ethnicity or race?
Maybe they do.
Okay.
But right now we're just putting all that, merging all that data and
sending it. I see. Yeah. So what, just sort of, you know, what could you say what sort of has been the most difficult or most challenging thing for the Latino community with the pandemic? Just to kind of summarize, you know, what we've been saying.
It's been not having the resources that the rest of the communities have, not having the types of jobs that afford them to be able to stay home and take care of themselves, you know, not having those safety nets in terms of money.
Yeah.
You know, because some people, you could tell them, well, listen, you have to stay home for the next 6 months. Well, if they have resources, some people can afford to do that.
Yeah.
They have savings and but in the Hispanic community, that hasn't been the case, you know. So, and in some industries, for example, I know the horse industry, the horse owners, they were telling them, don't worry, I'm still going to pay you.
Oh, good.
So they were doing that. But there were other industries where, like, they're independent contractors, like construction, landscaping, roofing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Or we had a lot of females that they clean homes.
Yeah.
So they work for themselves. They work for themselves. So if they don't go clean that home, they're not going to get paid in cash.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
So that, I would say, above anything else, that has been the number one thing that has affected them.
Yeah, yeah.
Not having financial resources that will help them. So, you know, the other part is like how scared they are because, you know, we have kind of like a percentage of our Hispanic community, I'll call them, it's like an underground community.
You know? Yeah.
They're not documented. So now they're also in fear that if they have to go to a hospital or get tested or treated, they might, you know, get taken and get deported. When that's something we constantly have to remind them, that's not our job. Our job here is to help them, and to help them be safe. Actually, this story, because this, I never forget this story. I had a case of a kid who was 16 years old from Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
He and his parents, they came from Guatemala when he was 14. While they were crossing the border, his parents died, both of them.
Wow.
He makes it to Kentucky somehow and to Lexington. And since age 14, he starts working in construction.
No way.
And his life has been living with different people that he meets while he works. Now he was 16, he becomes COVID, infected with COVID. So we have been trying to get a hold of him for days, and suddenly someone contacts me through my Facebook that they had this kid who was a 16-year-old kid with COVID, but he was too afraid to talk to us because he was afraid they were going to send him back to Guatemala. And then I'm able, through this person, to this third person, I was able to contact him. And this person was bringing him food. He was staying with a friend. But the issue was that the friend, knowing that he already had COVID, the friend was married, had two children, they wanted him out of the house. So here's
Wow.
the situation, because think about it, a 16-year-old, he's living pretty much then on the streets. He works. When I was thinking, when I was 16, I was just in high school. My life was very simple. Go to school, play around,
Yeah, that's
and that's where you see like the life that some people
yeah.
had to live. So, we were able to do the interview, assure him that he was gonna be okay. Through that third person, I connected that person with our Hispanic group. We have a Hispanic group of leaders of other agencies, and then
Okay.
they were going to help him, provide him like food, clothing, and helping him so he would get out of isolation.
Wow. Did he have symptoms then? Did he have a bad case?
No, he had had a little bit of a headache here and there, but nothing, because
Yeah,
that's the thing.
that's
This
good.
virus barely affects kids, in the percentage.
Wow.
A lot of asymptomatic people, just like when then in the Hispanic community, then when the virus started affecting the college students, we started having like, for example, I remember one day we had about 110 cases in one day, and about 90 were college students. They didn't have anything,
It
but.
doesn't faze them. No, but that's an amazing story. I mean, most some so many people aren't aware of, people really, people dealing with those kinds of circumstances in Lexington, They don't understand that immigrants are really many, some of these immigrants are really in desperate situations.
Yes, just like the people that work in the horse industry. I remember talking to this 19-year-old who, people in the horse industry, they work almost every day. So my questions would then would be, because you're just trying to do the interview, but you also want to talk, make them feel comfortable and have them express. And I will say, this kid was working for a horse farm 6 days a week, and for Kingland another 6 days a week. So he was 19, and he was saying, "I have a girlfriend." I said, "But do you have time for your girlfriend? Like, you work every day. Like, do you do things? Do you go out? Do you?" He said, "No, it's just, we work." And but his entire family was in the horse industry. And I was saying, "But do you have any aspirations? Like, would you like to go to college, have a degree, or this is what's going to be your life? Like, working, 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 working. Do you ever take a vacation? Do you ever travel?" And he sounds a little bit, "No." And I said, "That sounds like a, in a way, a sad life, because you're just pretty much working, working, working." So,
At 19.
yes. So the horse industry, people work a lot.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit before we end, a little bit about the surge that's happening right now. Is that, what is the surge? What's driving that, and is it affecting the Latino community at all?
I think it's affecting everybody. I think the surge is because people are burned out from COVID. They're, two things. They're burned out emotionally from COVID. They have seen at least if they're following how it is in Lexington, that the death rates are mostly affecting people above age 65. And they're just, maybe at this point, they have said, many have said to themselves, you know what? I'm just going to live my life. I'm going to try to be careful, but I'm not going to stop living. And if it hits me, I'll deal with it. And that's why we're getting these huge numbers right now. The only thing that I would tell people is, remember, COVID doesn't discriminate in terms of, like, it doesn't matter how healthy as a person you are or how young you are. It's like playing Russian roulette for real. Because it's like all about your genetics. And
True.
you could be the healthiest person, never suffer from anything, and you know, you could end up in the hospital. And actually, we've only had one case of a Hispanic person that was 30 years old that died. I interviewed her, and when she first got sick, you know, she was having some symptoms, but nothing major. And then weeks later, we hear that she was hospitalized. And I had to speak with her husband. And tell me, she had never suffered from anything. Nothing. You know, she was a very healthy individual. And then she ended up in the hospital. And 2 days later, she dies. So, you know, if there could be a testimony that they could show, you know, if you don't take care, and that's the danger, that it's actually playing Russian roulette. But right now, I think people are just tired and fed up, and this across the country.
And when you go on Facebook Live, do you share stories like that to, or when you're on the radio or in other formats, do you try
Well,
to
we no,
get people to take it seriously?
we mostly go about the numbers and what's happening in the city, and you know, we give them advice, and we always mention things about where we're having free clinics. And that's one good thing I would say about Lexington. Access to getting tested compared to other counties has been always very good. We've always had a lot of access. I have never heard of a case that they were telling me, oh, it was really hard for me to find a way to get tested. And we even have, actually, we've had it for months. We have a program where if you're an active case, for example, and you have five kids, we will bring you five test kits to your home. You can do the test them at home, and then we'll pick up everything, take it to the lab, and let you know. So we have a service for people that have transportation issues, and provide them with tests so they can get tested if they need to. So
Well, so we're sort of moving to the word of the end. Maybe is there any, thing that you would like to share that you've learned or that through this process? I know we're not through the pandemic at all, and that's probably what we'll come to in the next question. But, how has it personally been for you to sort of go through all of this? If you don't have anything to share on that, that's fine. I just thought I'd give you the chance.
No, I would just like to remind people that, you know, we are all in the same boat. You know, for example, I got engaged this year, and I haven't been able to celebrate my engagement. But you have to, as a person, you have to make a decision. You know, are you gonna take care of yourself? This is not a permanent situation. I believe that I understand that some people might see it like, well, this, I'm getting older, and I'm not gonna let this dictate my life. But you know, there's gonna be life after this. And I would tell people, try to stick to the basics. You know, if you just wear that mask, if you just wash your hands, and you keep that social distancing, which I do say this in the Facebook Live all the time. the worst type of situation, the type of situation that you really want to avoid is where you're going to be stuck in one place, surrounded with people that you don't know,
mm-hmm.
more than 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the situation where, whether are you in Kroger or Walmart in a long line, if the long it's a long line and you're going to be there for 20, 25 minutes and you're surrounded by people, that's not a good situation.
Yeah.
Whether you go to someone's house and there's a lot of people, whether that's the type of situation you want to avoid. You always want to be moving and in passive. If you're able to do that and stick to the basics, wear your mask, clean your hands, and social distancing, you could go all this pandemic without ever getting it.
But there are challenges with that. But how do you sort of see things going? You know, do you see people complying with that in the next few months until we get a vaccine, or how do you see this sort of playing out over the next few months?
We are going to continue to promote people to do the right thing, but I think every month that passes, people are just more tired. And that's the thing that, for example, everybody has social media. I'm sure that even you have your friends that they have been traveling. They have been going to Florida. They've been going. I have friends that they've gone to Cancun. They've gone here. They go, and they're fine.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
See those things and say, oh, well, then, you know, let me take advantage of the cheap flights, this. And I don't think that's going to change unless the governors, they start being more strict.
Yeah.
So at this point, is it going to get better? I don't see it happening at this point, because winter, people are doing more indoor things. People want to get together with the holidays with their families.
Yeah.
And then some people are just burnt out. And,
So
let's hope for the best, but as if you keep monitoring what I'm seeing, it's just increasing at about a 5 to 10% every week. So
It's going to be challenging with the holidays, keeping people, you know, wearing masks and not associating with people they don't hang out with a lot. So
and that's the challenge for the Hispanic community, because they tend to have big families. And I had a case of this family that they just did a birthday party because it was the 15th, you know, the Hispanic community, the 15th year of the girl is a big time. It was only her family, no friends. But her family here was about 35 people. And one of them happened to come in with the virus and spread it like fire.
Mm.
So that's going to be the hard part. You know, for example, my fiance's family here, okay, we're thinking about we are canceling Thanksgiving. We're going to cancel it. But now let's see. The grandmother, she's 91. And she's saying, but you don't know if I'm going to be here next year.
Mm, wow.
Are you going to cancel? So those are the pressures that I understand coming from the family.
Yeah.
You know, is she going to be here? Are you going to cancel? What if she's not here? Are you going to regret that?
Okay. Yeah.
What if we do and then someone comes and has it and that
affects
her? So those are the types of decisions that I know are really difficult to make now in the holidays.
It will be interesting to see what happens with the holidays. As you said, with everyone being tired and everyone wanting to get together, it's difficult.
But it sounds there's a light at the end of the tunnel, right? What we're hearing about those vaccinations, and actually what came out today, you know, that vaccine from Moderna, they say it's 95% effective. So actually Lexington, UK is going to be one of the testing sites.
Oh, great.
For the trials for the vaccinations. So soon I think they might be asking people who want to participate and get it beforehand. So I think we, you know, if a lot of people in Lexington starts getting vaccinated in the trial and we create that herd immunity, well, we could be a little bit more safer in Fayette County.
And your role might be next year promoting the vaccine? Was that what you would?
Actually, that's what it's going to be. They already told us that because that's the other component. When it comes time to doing mass vaccination for the entire city, that's going to be the health department.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why every year we do a free flu shot clinic. That's always been an emergency response testing scenario. We always see a drill that we've had for years. How we do mass vaccination? Well, soon that is going to be for real. We're going to have to do because there's a speculation about maybe 380,000 people in Lexington. Think about it. It's going to have to be all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Not only for the health department, but probably other providers helping and trying to vaccinate people. Yes.
Yeah. So it's been a very, very busy year for you, and next year will probably be even busier.
You know, at least my role will be creating awareness, talking, letting people know, you know, we have other, you know, nurses and stuff that work for us. Their role is going to be putting the actual vaccine and everybody has a role. So we're pretty good at it right now.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that we didn't add that you'd like to, you know, we didn't cover that you'd like to add?
No, I
think we did a pretty good job.
You know, hopefully, you know, they'll be able to understand me, you know, when they're trying to get the information to write it, you know, however they're going to use it.
It was really great. Yes, I really appreciate your time. And I will send you the release forms. And I can also share this with you if you'd be interested in having a copy of it.
Yeah, you know, and hopefully let me know when the project, you know, I would like to see it.
Yeah.
When are they trying to have this together for, like, next year?
They just asked me to do the interviews and then I give it to them. But I will keep you updated. I don't really know what their timeline is, but I'll let you know.
Well, I'm thinking that probably after the pandemic is over is when they're going to.
Yeah. Right. When people. Yeah, it'll probably be a year or two at least.
Okay.
But I really appreciate your time, Ruben, and I'll be in touch by email.
All right. Yeah, and send me those forms. It was really nice meeting you.
Good meeting you. Take care. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.